Welcome to the Israel Daily News Podcast. I'm your host, Shanna Fold, and I'm here to get you caught up quickly. I've got some top news stories for you today from Israel, and guess what? You're listening, so you're already on top of your game. Survive and thrive, people. Knowledge is the best weapon. Today is Thursday, April 9, 2026 in the Gregorian calendar, and the 22nd of Nisan, 5786 in the Hebrew calendar. Today, we are going to start with some news updates and then bring in our political and legal analyst, Binyamin Moalem, who will give us a very clear understanding of what the current ceasefire entails. Now, let's get to the news. This next news story had to be added in after my interview with Binyamin because the news update happened while we were recording our interview for the show. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel will begin direct negotiations with Lebanon, quote, as soon as possible, following repeated appeals from Lebanon's government to open dialogue. According to Netanyahu, the talks will focus on disarming Hezbollah, which is a terror organization that operates from inside of Lebanon, and that they're going to be working toward peaceful relations between the two countries, meaning between Israel and Lebanon. He's also welcomed a recent call by Lebanon's prime minister to demilitarize Beirut, calling this a positive step, Beirut being the capital. So meaning demilitarizing Lebanon, especially from Beirut and down, which is leading us toward the Israeli border. Our analyst, Binyamin, sent me the update about this as soon as he left our recording studio, but he noted that they're only talks. But it's definitely news worth mentioning, especially because Lebanon and Israel they don't really have a working relationship, unlike its other neighbors on the border, Egypt and Jordan, for which Israel does have normalization and peace deals signed. Pro-Iranian hacking group Handala claimed to have breached the phone of former IDF Chief of Staff Lieutenant General Herzi Halevi. The group claims the operation lasted years, resulting in at least 19,000 classified files being stolen. Handala is named after the pro-Palestinian cartoon character, which serves as a resistance symbol against Israel. A 22-year-old male from Haifa, identified as Ami Gaidarov, is in custody on suspicion of acting as an agent and carrying out missions for Iranian intelligence and renting an apartment for allegedly producing explosives in hopes of targeting former Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett. He allegedly documented the process to show proof of completion and even recruited others to test materials. Those suspects have also been detained as part of the ongoing investigation. According to the ongoing investigation, he has been in contact with an Iranian supervisor since August 2025. He received 70,000 shekels for his assignments, mostly received via digital wallets. This is the latest incident in a wave of espionage cases linked to Iran inside Israel in the recent months. After a wartime freeze, the criminal trial of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is scheduled to resume on Sunday. From the outbreak of the war on February 28, 2026, until now, Israel's court system operated under emergency statuses, but now those restrictions have been lifted. And so basically, we had one day today after Passover and one day after the first day of ceasefire. And so getting started at the beginning of the week here in Israel on Sunday, the trial is resuming in the middle of Netanyahu's cross-examination in a long-standing corruption case and multiple cases, case 1000, 2000, and 4000. Netanyahu was indicted in 2019 on charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. He has denied all wrongdoing. He took the stand for the first time in December 2024, becoming the first sitting Israeli prime minister to act as a defendant to stand trial. On Thursday, Education Minister Yoav Kish announced plans to expand the Education Ministry's summer program for elementary school students by 3 weeks and launch a new program for middle school students, since there have been weeks of school closures due to the Iran war. Young people and little ones have been home with their parents for more than a month, and no kids have been in day school and daycare. And trust me, parents have had enough. Limitations are still in place for northern Israel and northern border communities due to the ongoing threat from Hezbollah. The plan does not extend regular studies into the summer, but it expands an existing program which is called Summer Vacation School, which is run by the Education Ministry and offers state-supported summer programs for kids after the school year ends. It has not yet been approved by the government, and the finance ministry stated that it lacks funding despite a 750 million shekel budget. But the good news is that kids can go back to school for the time being while Israel is hanging on to a fragile ceasefire, which we're going to talk about soon. The ceasefire is about to be on for 2 weeks. It was announced on the last night of Passover here in Israel. And I can tell you that I feel relief in the air. To discuss the ins and outs, we have here with us Binyamin Moalem. Moalem is deeply engaged in Israeli current events and policy discussions. Having worked as a foreign law clerk at the Supreme Court of Israel, he has a unique vantage point on Israeli jurisprudence. Binyamin now devotes much of his time to curating and explaining current events and politics in Israel on his popular Instagram page, By Moalem, where he provides balanced news coverage from an Israeli perspective for those seeking to be informed without an extensive time investment. Binyamin has authored several thought-provoking feature op-eds and has been featured as a guest lecturer at Bar-Ilan University in Israel. Let's bring him in. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Shanna. Good to be back.
So there have been a lot of rumors and confusions over this ceasefire, which was announced right going into the last Chag, the last holiday of Passover, the last night of Passover in Israel, and the last two nights of Passover for the rest of the world outside of Israel is observed, meaning that people go offline, they go off their phones. And so a lot of us here in Israel, myself included, despite I'm a journalist, found out that there was a ceasefire at synagogue on Wednesday morning. Can you tell us what is the premise of this recent ceasefire?
All right. So we already knew for several days now that President Trump was putting a lot of pressure on Iran to make a deal to end the war. Otherwise, he would destroy their energy infrastructure, among other things. He even put out a post on his Truth Social saying that he would destroy a civilization, which raised a lot of eyebrows around the world. So in the last second, Iran, despite digging in for quite some time now, saying they would not agree to a temporary deal, that they would maintain their hold on the Strait of Hormuz as part of any deal and the right to enrich uranium, they did agree to a temporary ceasefire, a two-week ceasefire that began two nights ago at 3 a.m. Israel time, 8 p.m. Eastern time in the United States. But since then, there have been a lot of disputes as to what the terms of this temporary ceasefire are. Now, while Iran did back down from its insistence that it would not agree to a temporary ceasefire and wanted a comprehensive deal, they did agree to this two-week deal. But the terms of this deal, apparently there's a big dispute between the United States and Iran as to what the terms are, just even for these 2 weeks. As far as Iran is concerned and the Pakistani mediators, and again, Pakistan facilitated these talks. They, you know, at the end of the day, this was a decision that had to be made by President Trump. As far as Iran is concerned, the war in Lebanon that Israel is waging against Hezbollah is part of this ceasefire. However, we know for a fact that's not the case because Israel launched its largest bombing campaign of Lebanon since the start of this war yesterday after the ceasefire in Iran went into effect. As far as Iran is concerned, the U.S. recognized their right to enrich uranium, something the United States says did not happen. And as far as Iran is concerned, they can now impose tolls on ships traversing the Straits of Hormuz, something the United States also is saying is not part of the deal. So this is a very fragile ceasefire right now. And we'll have to see what happens in the next 2 weeks, if it even lasts that long. The United States is sending a delegation this weekend to Pakistan to discuss the ceasefire with Iran. Unclear if this is going to be indirect or direct, but these talks will be led by Vice President J.D. Vance, Jared Kushner, and Steve Witkoff, the president's envoy.
Why Pakistan?
So that's a good question, and apparently they managed to fill this void, this vacuum, I guess, of countries that wanted to facilitate talks. China was very much involved as well. Pakistan doesn't really have that much sway over either country, certainly not the United States. Yes, they might be in the sphere of influence along with China and Russia, but it was China that leaned on Iran to accept this temporary deal. And China is the largest purchaser of oil from Iran in the world. So they certainly have a lot of influence there. And the talks are going to take place in Islamabad this Saturday, I believe.
Can you explain to us a little bit about the Kurg Island, the island off the coast of Iran? I think there's a lot of confusion about why the U.S. has interest there and what's going to happen and what the U.S. should do with this island, because the U.S. has stated that they want to take over this island. So can you give us a little clarity there?
Sure. So Iran has a number of strategic islands in the Persian Gulf. One of them is Kharg Island. This is in the northern part of the Persian Gulf. This is the terminal through which 90% of Iran's oil gets shipped through. So any oil that is pumped, 90% of the oil that is pumped in Iran, and there's a lot of it, gets sent to Kharg Island, where it's then loaded onto ships and sent out to the various countries, or really just China, but that it can export oil to. So basically, this is a very, very important island for Iran's oil infrastructure. And if the U.S. were to take it, something that President Trump was threatening to do, they would then have control of Iranian oil exports. There's three islands also near the Straits of Hormuz that the U.S. was threatening to take over. Iran did not charge tolls prior to this war in the Strait of Hormuz. It was a free access waterway. Ships traversed it. Again, there's a lot of Gulf states that ship their oil through the Strait of Hormuz as well. Qatar, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, United Arab Emirates.
What are the bordering countries over here that are on this?
So the Strait of Hormuz is the bottleneck of the Strait of Hormuz is between Iran and Oman. But along the coast of the Persian Gulf on the western side, you have Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, United Arab Emirates. And in the north part, you've got Kuwait. And these are all countries that ship oil through the Straits of Hormuz. And these are also countries that were attacked by Iran during the war. So they are they do not want to have to pay tolls that would cause the price of oil to go up. I mean, it has already gone up. But it is very important to them that this remain a free waterway. And also to other countries that get their oil from this waterway, namely the countries on the European continent that would be affected by it. The United States pumps its own oil, but again, the oil prices are a global market. So regardless of how much oil the U.S. pumps, the price of oil is going to be dictated by the global market.
What has the United States sort of threatened or suggested that they're going to do with this island?
So they threatened to take Kharg Island. They would send in ground troops, seize the island, and then they would have control of all of Iran's oil export, or almost all of Iran's oil exports. And using that, they could then leverage that to force Iran to give up its nuclear stockpile. Now, remember, this is going to be a main part of the talks this weekend. As far as Israel's concerned, if we're looking at it just from Israel's perspective, the most important thing out of this talks is Iran get rid of the 450 kilos of highly enriched uranium that it has. Now, throughout this war, Iran's ability to enrich uranium has been destroyed. Its ability to build ballistic missiles has been destroyed. Much of its military production systems have been destroyed. Hundreds of its political and military leadership have been killed. Iran has been set back considerably to what it was 40 days ago. But this stockpile of enriched uranium gives it a head start should it decide one day to rebuild its centrifuges, its enrichment capabilities, and then they could take the stockpile and really quickly build up 11 bombs with it. So it's very important, as far as Israel's concerned, to get this out of there. And I think one of the goals of taking Kharg Island would be, as far as Trump is concerned, take the oil or have control over the oil, which makes the United States have significant leverage over Iran. But also they could leverage that with Iran's control over the Strait of Hormuz. They could leverage that with Iran's stockpile of uranium and say, okay, you want Kharg Island back? Well, give us the uranium, open up the Strait of Hormuz, and right now, we're seeing that despite the fact that we're a day and a half into the ceasefire, Iran still has not completely opened the Strait of Hormuz yet. And President Trump predicated this whole ceasefire on the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz.
Thank you for breaking that down for us. What would you say have been the successes and what is outstanding in the last 40 days that the U.S. and Israel has gone in against Iran in this war? So what has been achieved and what is yet to be achieved?
Okay, so we're hearing a lot, you know, it's funny that at the end of these wars, you'll see countries like Iran declaring victory, which is laughable given the state of where Iran is right now following the war. However, Iran is a dictatorship. And in a dictatorship, when the goal is to survive, and as of now, they have survived, so that's a win. Whereas in democratic societies, you've got oppositions coming up and saying, you know, and this is true in Israel, it's true in the United States. You know, what was the point of this? You know, we lost the war, we didn't go hard enough. Now, the voices we're hearing from the opposition in Israel is very different than the opposition in the United States. But if we're looking at this from an apolitical lens, on one hand, there is no doubt that there have been significant achievements, certainly for Israel, for the United States as well. And there are certain goals that have not yet been reached. So what are the achievements? So right now, we are 40 days after the war started. Iran's leadership has been completely decimated, essentially. As far as we can tell, I mean, they have a new supreme leader. Iran's constitution requires the country to be run by a cleric. And right now, it's Ayatollah Mojtaba Khomeini.
The son of the previous one.
Reports out earlier this week suggest that he is unresponsive and still seriously injured from the wounds he sustained in the attack that killed his father at the beginning of the war, and that Iran is largely being run by the IRGC and what's left of its leadership. The head of the IRGC was killed. The number two guy in the IRGC was killed. There was a new guy who was promoted to the head of the IRGC, Ahmed Vahidi, and he, along with Mohammad Khalibaf, who is a previous general in the IRGC and now the speaker of the Iranian parliament, he is essentially running the country, as far as we can tell. He's going to be the one in charge of negotiations on behalf of Iran. But a lot of the military and political leadership of Iran has been decimated. So if you think about it, you know, it's hard because it's not a one-to-one, but imagine if on the first day of the war, a missile took out the entire U.S. cabinet and leadership, and then all of its military generals, or a large majority of the military generals, and then all you have left is the Speaker of the House and, you know, a few lower-ranking generals running the country and the military. So that's essentially what you have in Iran right now from a leadership perspective. Now, prior to this war, Iran was believed to have about 2,500 missiles. The U.S. says it destroyed about half of those. Hundreds of them are deep underground, but were plugged, meaning the openings to the tunnels that they have these missile cities underground in deep bunkers have been bombed, so it'll take a while to dig them out. Iran would still have several hundred, if not a thousand, let's say, missiles at most, which is a considerable amount of missiles. However, its ability to rebuild missiles has been decimated. Now, over the summer, the factories that were where they manufactured the raw materials for building these missiles was destroyed, but there were still many missile parts that had not been destroyed. So from the June war until this war, Iran was able to build dozens, if not hundreds, of missiles using these prefabricated parts. They no longer have that ability. And also the plants, the petrochemical plants that were used to bring the materials needed to build the missile parts, have also been destroyed. So Iran no longer has the ability to rebuild its missile systems. Its nuclear program has been decimated. Now, the main thing is this stockpile of 450 kilograms of oil, of enriched uranium, about 1,000 pounds. This is something that, again, is very important to Israel that gets removed from Iran that has not been accomplished yet. And most significantly, at the end of the day, while President Trump likes to say that there is a regime change, there is a change of leadership in Iran, but there is no change in the regime. It's still the Islamic Republic. And as far as the people of Iran are concerned, you know, at least the majority of them that do not like the Islamic Republic, that is still an issue. And as far as Israel is concerned, long term, that is also an issue, because so long as the Islamic Republic is in power, whether it takes one decade, two decades, three decades, they're going to have revenge on their mind. And they're going to do everything they can to rebuild their missile capabilities, to rebuild their nuclear enrichment program, unless there's some ironclad deal with the United States that prevents that. Because any deal with the United States will also release sanctions on Iran, presumably, and that would bring in billions of dollars into the Iranian economy, and they could use that money to rebuild their military, which they certainly will try to do. So Israel will want to make sure and lobby the United States that that rebuilding process does not involve any threat to Israel. And also the Gulf states, they've been lobbying President Trump to finish the job. They really, really do not like Iran. And Iran's thought process going into the war was, well, if we bomb the Gulf states, they're going to pressure Trump to stop because they're not going to want to be involved in the war. But the opposite happened. They've been lobbying President Trump to finish the job and destroy the regime in Iran. And so President Trump will have a lot of pressure from Israel, from the Gulf states, to make a very strong deal. Whereas he back home, the war was not very popular, though it was, if this is the end of it, it was relatively short compared to, very much so compared to previous wars that the U.S. was involved in over the past quarter of a century. So these are the things that we're going to have to work out moving forward. And Israel is really hoping that that uranium gets taken out and that any sanctions relief on Iran also includes ironclad guarantees regarding its nuclear program, its ballistic missile program, and its proxies in the region that Hamas and Hezbollah and the Houthis and others do no longer get funding from Iran.
We're in a ceasefire right now. Can you describe for us what a ceasefire means? And a lot of people have here in Israel have said there's never a solution in the Middle East. It's a ceasefire until the next ceasefire. And, you know, when I heard someone say that to me, just someone that I was speaking with, I don't even remember who it was in the street, someone said to me, you know, there's never going to be peace here because we only ever live in between the moments of ceasefire, and it's been like that since the beginning of Israel's time as a nation. So can you, first of all, respond to that? And second, for those who don't live in Israel and have not been under sirens and alerts and running into the shelter, can you explain what the difference is between life 2 days ago and life now?
All right, so for your first question for ceasefire, I'll quote what General Dan Kane, he's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the U.S. military, he said yesterday when talking about the ceasefire, he said, a ceasefire, by definition, is temporary, meaning we can always resume fighting. And you are correct. Israel, for its entire history, is living between wars. Now, Israel does have two peace treaties with countries that were previously at war with it, namely Egypt and Jordan. And Israel has not been at war with either country since the peace treaties were signed. However, Israel's wars are now largely with terrorist organizations like Hamas and Hezbollah. The war with Iran, Israel has been at war with Lebanon, but that's largely been against terrorist organizations, whether it's Hezbollah, the last two, three wars, and then in 1982 was a war against the PLO.
And I want to ask you about Hezbollah after this, so don't
sure.
really forget.
So yes, and that is unfortunately the way it is. And there's a lot of frustration in Israel. Like, why can't we just defeat the enemy once and for all? But it's very hard to do that when you've got, whether it's Hamas and you've got a population nearby that is not very friendly towards Israel, and many of them do support Hamas. And it's going to be very hard to completely root out the ideology. And as long as the ideology is around, you're going to have people who want to put that ideology into play. And I think a lot of people in the West don't understand that you cannot live a normal life the same way you might live in the United States when you have people who are your neighbors who want to kill you and will do anything to kill you and do not view negotiations and peace deals the same way you do through a Western lens. And Hamas and Hezbollah certainly do not do that. And neither does the Iranian regime. The Iranian regime has made it its MO of death to Israel. And death to America as well, meaning America's a lot farther away, but Iran before the war was believed to be about 8 years away from having an intercontinental ballistic missile that would be capable of reaching the United States. And so, so that's something that Israel wants to make sure that it no longer has to deal with Iran, which is, as many of the metaphor many used in Israel, is the head of the octopus, and all its tentacles are the terrorist organizations that it funds and arms. And so Israel has done a great deal of damage to Hamas, a great deal of damage to Hezbollah, and even has inflicted several blows, significant blows, on the Houthis, and now significant blows to the head of the octopus. But unless the octopus is put to sleep, meaning the regime is toppled, which is not something that Israel or the United States could do from the outside, then it once it resurrects itself, absent some ironclad guarantees in any future deal, then, you know, whether it takes a decade, 2 decades, 3 decades, so long as the regime is still intact, they're going to want revenge, and they're going to want to make good on their goal of destroying Israel. And again, Iran is the largest state sponsor of terrorism in the world. So this, it doesn't only involve Israel. Terrorist attacks around the world are funded by Iran. So, you know, since September 11th, you know, the deaths of Americans in terrorist attacks have almost, the majority of them have been because of Iran, or proxies funded by Iran. So this is something that is of paramount importance, obviously, to Israel because it's an existential threat, but also to America and the rest of the world as well. As for your second question of how our life is different, well,
he's very good, ladies and gentlemen, because I didn't remember my second question. So thank you very much, Binyamin.
So that is, it's hard to describe. It's like you need to, I have friends who live here who they cannot speak to their friends in America because it's something that you need to experience. It's really not something that you can describe, that you are constantly, like, subconsciously on edge at any second. You get this really, really, if you're familiar with Amber Alerts in the United States.
I already feel nervous because you just said it, and I've been so happy today and so relaxed today, and I literally danced around in my living room this morning and went for a happy stroll outside because I feel so thrilled that I'm not waiting. And just the little moments, like jumping in the shower, and I thought, let me go get my phone because I might miss the alert. And then I thought to myself, wait, I'm not going to get an alert today because we're in a ceasefire, so I can leave my cell phone out of the bathroom. These are the types of thoughts that are running through our minds in the background.
Yes, Israelis can take a shower without bringing their cell phone in. They don't, you know, Israelis who observe Shabbat don't have to walk around on Shabbat with their cell phones in their pockets, you know, for the sole purpose of being alerted if there is a ballistic missile coming towards Israel, and then having enough time to seek shelter if they're not near one. So it's always a subconscious stress that's on the back of your mind that at any moment the alert could go off. You know, at certain times, it's hard to fall asleep because you're worried, like, the second I fall asleep, I'm going to get an alert and I won't sleep. You know, many Israelis were extremely sleep deprived for quite some time. And to keep in mind, the residents of northern Israel who have gotten it double, not just from Iran, but from Hezbollah as well, and with a lot less time, you know, a lot less warning time when the missile comes from Hezbollah.
A lot of no warning at all.
Sometimes, you know, very few seconds, they still are under a threat of missile fire from Hezbollah, and that's something Israel is working to take care of on its northern border inside of Lebanon.
Okay, so we're now here at Hezbollah, and I do remember my question about Hezbollah. So just yesterday, a friend of mine, international, she's actually in Mexico City, sent me a screenshot of the push notification that she got on her phone saying that the ceasefire is with doubts because Israel is shelling Hezbollah. Now, I think to an audience or to communities that don't even know that Hezbollah is a terror organization that is operating within Lebanon, which is supposed to be, you know, its own state, that there's a terror group living within the state, within the country of Lebanon, that looks very hostile. It looks like Israel is not holding up their end of the bargain. Now, I know, and you know, what a threat Hezbollah is to Israel, has always been, and even before things have fired up with Iran, there have been issues with Hezbollah for a long time. So there's no Israeli who is confused about why Israel is still dealing with Hezbollah, almost as if Hezbollah is its own entity, because in a way it is. It's a proxy, but they're still operating by their own accord. So for an audience that really doesn't understand that background, can you explain the leg of this ceasefire in which Israel continues to shell Hezbollah in Lebanon, despite Iran is trying to convey that Hezbollah is one in the same with the IRGC?
So, as I said earlier when we were describing the terms of the ceasefire, Iran says that a ceasefire with Lebanon, meaning Hezbollah, is part of the deal for the ceasefire. Pakistan said as much in its announcement of the ceasefire late Tuesday night, early Wednesday Israel time. But the U.S. and Israel never agreed to that. President Trump backed Israel's assertion that Lebanon is not part of this deal. And again, remember, Israel is not part of this ceasefire directly with Iran. It was more President Trump, because Israel is allied with the United States, said, okay, we're stopping, and Israel agreed to go along with President Trump. Again, you know, it was obvious that Israel was going to agree with President Trump's stance on this, but Israel has always maintained that the two fronts are separate from one another. If we agree to a ceasefire with Iran, that doesn't mean we're done with Hezbollah. And Hezbollah, prior to October 7th, was the single largest threat to Israel's border event, meaning we're talking about a terrorist organization that was more powerful than many militaries in Europe, and obviously much more powerful than the Lebanese military. And even now, despite the weakened state of Hezbollah, the Lebanese government and military, despite what might be their best efforts, if you are to believe them, that the Lebanese government cannot keep them in check. The Lebanese government said that they were going to disarm Hezbollah. They did not. They said that they disarmed Hezbollah south of the Litani River. Hezbollah has fired 3,000 missiles from south of the Litani River at Israel since the start of this war. So clearly, Lebanon lied or didn't know what they were talking about. So this is a very significant threat. It's a terrorist organization that, again, its goal is to wipe Israel out. And from a lens, from a country of, you know, and we've heard a lot of condemnations from a lot of European countries over the past day saying, well, Israel should not be fighting in Lebanon. If there's a ceasefire in Iran, Israel needs to stop the war in Lebanon, stop the war in Lebanon. But these countries don't have to live with Hezbollah on their doorstep. Israel does. And the residents of northern Israel want to see Hezbollah gone. They've been a threat to their homes. Kiryat Shmona, one of the northernmost towns in Israel, I think half of the people have returned since the previous war in 2024. It's just people are at wit's end, and they cannot. They want Israel to finish the job against Hezbollah. Just like Israelis, we talked about the stress and the fatigue of having to run back and forth in bomb shelters and having to think about when the next siren might be. You know, times multiply that by however much it is for those living in northern Israel. Israelis were willing to do it if it meant this takes care of the problem once and for all. And that goes doubly so for the residents of northern Israel who have to deal with constant attacks from Hezbollah. So yes, Hezbollah is a terrorist organization. They are funded by Iran. Hopefully that'll stop. And they are a significant threat to Israel. And if they are allowed to rebuild themselves and allowed to rearm themselves, they're not doing that for the sole purpose of attacking Israel. They're not doing that. They don't run a country. There's a Lebanese government that runs Lebanon. So they don't need that to defend themselves. They're doing it only for the purpose of attacking Israel.
And why do the IRGC and Hezbollah and all the proxies want to destroy Israel?
Well, it's part of their fundamentalist religious beliefs that this is Islamic land and there should not be any Jewish presence or at least Jewish autonomy in this region. The entire Middle East was colonized by the early Muslims between 1,000 and 1,400 years ago. And again, keep in mind that Iran is Shiite. Most of the Middle East is Sunni. Historically, they hate each other more than they hate the Jews. What we've been seeing over the past few decades is a moderation of many of the Sunni states, the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, which has been quietly growing closer to Israel. But you still have the Shiites, who are a minority of the Muslim world in the Middle East, especially, who are still extremely, very extreme, meaning the Islamic State in Iran, of course. And they have been funding all of these terrorist organizations in the region, Hezbollah, a number of groups in Iraq, notably Kataib Hezbollah, which is another group with a similar name in Iraq, the Houthis, and the one Sunni group, perhaps two if you include the Islamic Jihad. You've got Hamas and Islamic Jihad, which receive funding from Iran, even though they're Sunni groups, because they have the same goal as the Iranian regime of destroying Israel. So if they can, you know, if they were ever, God forbid, successful, then they would turn their guns on each other.
The front page of the New York Times, international edition at minimum, last weekend came out. The front cover said, Israel tries to push Shiites out of Lebanon. Was essentially the headline, okay? Very shocking to see something like that so generalized, so without any context. Can you respond to that?
All right, so it's important to note that southern Lebanon is largely Shiite. And it's not just Shiites who want to live their life and who happen to be Shiites. These are people who really, literally, quite literally brought Hezbollah into their homes. I know people who are soldiers who served in southern Lebanon. They told me they don't think there was a single home or very, very few homes that they went into in southern Lebanon that did not have weapons or missiles belonging to Hezbollah. Hezbollah strategically placed weapons and missiles throughout the villages in southern Lebanon, the Shiite villages. There are a couple of Christian ones. And so when people say, these aren't, you know, innocent people who are living there, and Hezbollah took full advantage of the population there, and it seems the population was more than happy to give them that advantage, to open their doors. Apparently they were making money. They were getting rent from Hezbollah for the use of their property for military purposes. And Israel now wants to push Hezbollah back from the border. The Lebanese government is not doing that. Israel needs to create a security zone in southern Lebanon, similar to what it did in, or what it has in Gaza right now, by creating a buffer between, in Gaza you've got a buffer between Hamas and Israel, because Israel does not want another October 7th to happen. And Israel now needs a buffer between Israel and Hezbollah, because Hezbollah is hell-bent on destroying Israel. So we're not going to let them do that. We're not going to let them fire missiles on northern Israel. And the bigger the buffer, the more time the residents of northern Israel will have in the event of a missile attack. So when Israel is raising Shiite villages in southern Israel, it's not because these are innocent people who are there. It's because they were essentially bases for Hezbollah throughout the southern border of Lebanon.
Thank you for that. Take us through forward into the next 2 weeks. What can we expect? What could we not expect? What could we be confused about? And what are the, regarding this ceasefire, what can we expect to see if X happens or if Y does not happen? Take us forward.
All right. So part of this question involves getting into President Trump's head, which that's anybody's guess. As of now, we're at, as I said, is a very fragile ceasefire. There's huge gaps that need to be bridged between the U.S. and Iran, whether it's nuclear issues, whether it's their missile programs, whether it's their funding of regional proxies, whether it's the Strait of Hormuz. A lot of Iran has at least outwardly made some very principled claims that are very extreme and very far away from what the U.S. red lines are. And the U.S. is not going to allow that. Now, we do know that what Iran says is not necessarily what they do. They said that they would not, under any circumstances, agree to a temporary ceasefire, yet they did. So it's quite possible they will make concessions. It is believed that they are willing to make concessions on their nuclear program. However, those concessions do not appear to be enough to satisfy U.S. and certainly not Israeli demands for their nuclear program, meaning, namely, getting rid of their stockpile or allowing them to enrich uranium on their soil. So a lot has to be bridged here. What we could see is a number of things. We could see it falling apart. We could see it fall apart before the 2 weeks are up. We could see things kind of moving along, or from our vantage point, not moving along. And then when we get to the 2 week deadline, President Trump saying, okay, you know, similar to what he did over the week before the ceasefire went into effect, making threats towards Iran, saying, okay, I'm going to give you guys another 10 days. I'll give you guys another week. You know, he gave them an extra, he told, when he was asked about when he extended the deadline by 10 days, he said, that's it, I'm not doing it again. At the very last moment, he gave them an extra 24 hours. It's unclear if he did that intentionally or not. He posted a time on his Truth Social, and that was 24 hours after the original deadline. And I'm wondering if he and the U.S. and Israel had a bunch more targets they wanted to hit, so he extended the deadline by a day, knowing that eventually there will be some sort of ceasefire, but we need an extra day to hit a bunch of targets. That's possible, I'm guessing. But so it's very hard to know where this is going. On the face of it, I wouldn't be optimistic because in terms of a deal getting done, just because the sides are so far apart. However, President Trump has been able to either get what he wants or spin things in a way that he can declare victory at the end of it. So it's very, very tough to know what's going to happen. At any event, if, as far as Israel is concerned, Iran has been set back considerably right now. if that stockpile of uranium could be taken out of Iran and Iran is prohibited from enriching uranium, it'll be a tremendous victory from Israel's perspective.
You talked about what President Trump has been saying, the threats he's been making, the posts that he posts on his social media platform, Truth Social. What do you think that non-Westerners or Iranians and people from the East are hearing? Do you think that they're tuned in to what President Trump says? Do you think their messages are largely coming from the IRGC in their news outlets? What do you think that the other side is understanding?
So if you're talking about Iran, then yes, all of their news comes from state media, and the state media dictates what they see, what they hear, and the messages that they get. We do know, though, that Iran's government, when it would speak to the U.S. press, they were speaking with the American people and the opposition in mind. Abbas Araghchi, the foreign minister of Iran, often would show up on U.S. talk shows and news shows and basically paint the picture of, we are these victims, your president, who he knows is not very popular in the United States, for sure among, you know, Democrats. And, you know, they came and attacked us for no reason. You know, we're innocent people. And he would paint a sob story for Iran on U.S. news shows almost on a weekly basis. Though he did have a number of faux pas, like when he was asked, how come you get to have internet so that you could talk to me, but nobody else in Iran gets internet? And he said, well, somebody needs to speak up on behalf of the Iranian people, and that's my job. When he is not a democratically elected foreign minister, he has been appointed, and therefore he does not represent the Iranian people. But that aside, so yes, if you live in Iran, the news you're receiving, and despite that, and despite the internet blackouts, there have been ways for news to get in and news to come out, but it has been difficult. Just like we saw in, you know, January 8th, when the Iranian government killed what reports say were tens of thousands of people during an internet blackout. Eventually, some of the stories got out, but it took a while. And once it was done, Iran tried to spin the story of like, no, this were the terrorists, the people who are against the government, who are behind it. But that's the messages the Iranian are getting.
Last question for you. What is the current status of the Strait of Hormuz?
So as of yesterday, only 7 ships were allowed to traverse the Strait of Hormuz. On an average day prior to the war, we were looking at 135, 140 ships per day. Iran is saying that it's going to charge a toll for ships. During the war, there were countries that paid Iran millions of dollars to allow their ships to go through. Now, keep in mind, Iran's no longer really has a navy. Their navy has largely been destroyed by the United States. But to lay a mine in the Strait of Hormuz, which I think believe is like 22 miles wide, all you need is a speedboat. Or you could have a drone that could drop bombs on these massive oil tankers that are traversing it. So long as that threat is there, and Iran has said that it will bomb any ship that crosses without its permission, ships aren't going to want to cross. The insurance companies for these ships aren't going to allow them to cross. They're going to say, we're not insuring you if you cross the, they already said it, apparently, we're not going to insure you. A report in the Financial Times yesterday said that Iran is looking to charge $1 per barrel that crosses, which is a lot because there's hundreds of millions of barrels we're talking about. And this is not going to fly, not with the Gulf states. They're certainly not interested in paying Iran hundreds of millions of dollars to allow their ships to go through. The U.S. is not going to allow that, even though the U.S. doesn't really get its oil from there. Or doesn't have to get its oil from there. So that is something that is going to be a key part of these negotiations in the coming weeks.
Benjamin, is there anything that you want to leave us with? Anything you want to share? Anything else that's on you?
I think we covered all the points today.
We certainly did. What's on my mind right now is the nieces, and I believe there were more than one.
I think it was a sister and a niece.
Sister and a niece of Qasem Soleimani, who was assassinated by the United States years ago.
2020.
Living a very Western-looking lifestyle.
Yeah, very Western-looking lifestyle.
Shoulders out, cleavage out. Meanwhile, they're relatives and metaphoric relatives all throughout Iran don't have those privileges.
Yeah, and a few months ago there was a big scandal in Iran when Ali Shamkhani, who was the number three guy in Iran after the Ayatollah and Ali Larijani, who was later killed, but Shamkhani was killed along with Ayatollah Khomeini on the first day of the war. There were photos or videos of his daughter's wedding going around, of him walking his daughter down the aisle, and she was wearing a very revealing wedding dress with her hair uncovered. And people in Iran wanted to know why what we need to do is not what the people in charge need to do. And your point is definitely well taken. And that's part of the reason why many in Iran are fed up with the regime there.
And what's interesting about it is that that rumor and that news made it all the way over here to Israel. So it's, you know, it's a small world. And what one person does is certainly a statement. And so I just find that sort of sociologically fascinating. Thank you so much for being with us here today, Binyamin. You really answered every single one of our questions. And I hope
pleasure.
That my questions reflect the questions that the international community has about what's going on.
Hope so as well.
Not just today, but in this global scenario that we're in. So thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Well, that is it for today's show. Today is Thursday, April 9th, 2025. Tel Aviv has a low of 16 degrees Celsius and a high of 19 degrees. That's 60 degrees Fahrenheit for the low, going up to 66 degrees for the high. We are everywhere. Don't forget to sign up to our Israel Weekly News Wrap. The Israel Weekly News Wrap is a newsletter with the top five stories coming out of Israel from throughout the week. And of course, it has a personal note from me at the top. You can sign up for that at israeldailynews.org. Scroll down to the bottom and drop your email address in. Have a great and productive day and an excellent weekend. Shabbat shalom, everyone. Happy ceasefire. Enjoy these next 2 weeks. As much quiet as you can get.